Good morning to all of you. It's nice to see you again. I feel like I have some friends now after being here for 3 days in my audience. Before I get started, I'd like you to know that all of this morning's lecture is included in your handout, with the exception of the diagrams and the photographs in the visual slides. So I'd really like you to focus your attention on that. And I also want you to know that the hospital where I practice, St. Francis Medical Center in Pittsburgh, has really made a gift to you and to me by preparing all of these slides to help you, and I want to thank them for that. Now let's begin with our topic of infertility treatment. If we could have the first slide, please. At least 15% of married couples, or about 4.5 million couples in the United States, will experience some degree of infertility. And infertility, simply defined, is the inability of a couple to achieve conception after a year of unprotected intercourse, or the inability to carry pregnancies to a live birth. Next slide, please. Approximately 40% of infertility is a problem solely of the female. About 40% is a problem solely of the male. And in about 20% of cases, there's a problem found with both members of the couple. Next slide. About 3 to 10% of infertility problems are unexplained once a thorough evaluation of both partners has been conducted. A 1988 report from the Federal Office of Technology Assessment indicated that infertile couples in the United States made approximately 1.6 million visits to their physicians trying to build families, and they spent approximately $1 billion in the process. Despite the fact that the cause for infertility can be established about 90% of the time, really only 50 to 60% of those who receive expert medical care will achieve a successful pregnancy. Many more will become parents through adoption, while others will decide to live without children. According to one study, the stress of infertility is second only to the stress caused by the death of a loved one. Medical science now offers numerous treatments to relieve the suffering caused by infertility. What I'd like to do first is to present an overview of the most common methods of treatment that are currently in use, followed by a detailed discussion of the ethics involved with each modality of treatment. Now, the first method of treatment is surgical therapies for the female. This could include surgical removal of endometriosis. It could include fallopian tube repair or reanastomosis, which is essentially reconnecting tubes that were ligated surgically. It could also involve correction of anomalies of the uterus or reproductive tract, which are congenital in nature. Next slide. Surgical therapies for the male include varicocele repair, which is the ligation of dilated scrotal veins, which tends to cause a low sperm count. It could include the repair of ejaculatory duct obstruction, and it could include testicular biopsies. Next slide. Hormonal therapies may be used for either the male or the female, but ovulation induction for the female is the most common. Artificial insemination is of two types. AIH is direct introduction of the husband's sperm into the cervix or uterus. AID is direct introduction of donated sperm into the cervix or uterus. In vitro fertilization is the fertilization of eggs by contact with sperm in a test tube, followed by placement of one or more resulting embryos into the uterus. This is where we start our alphabet soup. The GIFT procedure, or gamete intrafallopian transfer, is the intraoperative transfer of sperm and egg into the fallopian tube of the woman. ZIFT, or zygote intrafallopian transfer, is the intraoperative transfer of zygotes into the fallopian tube of the woman. Surrogate embryo transfer is when a consenting surrogate mother is artificially inseminated with the husband's sperm. The resulting embryo is lavaged or washed out of the uterus and transferred to the uterus of the infertile wife. Surrogate motherhood. A consenting surrogate mother is artificially inseminated with the husband's sperm, and she carries the resulting pregnancy through to delivery. And finally, we have adoption, or the granting of full familial privileges to a totally unrelated child. At the present time, you see that there are at least 10 options available for the treatment of infertility. And each of these options may have several variations as well, depending on the circumstances of the couple involved or the preferences of the treating physician. Now let's consider each of these methods in detail. First, let's discuss surgical therapies. I personally have no reservations about any of these corrective procedures per se. But as a surgeon, I have on several occasions been asked by unmarried women to provide surgical repairs that are required only to permit reproduction. These operations would not otherwise be medically necessary. Obviously, if I perform these operations, I would in fact be encouraging sexual relations among unmarried couples. To date, it has been my policy not to provide infertility treatment for unmarried couples. And as you might guess, my position has not been well accepted by some of my patients. In addition, one encounters the problem of infertility surgery being desired by indigent patients who are on welfare and who receive their medical care through charity-based clinics. Formerly as a resident and now as a private physician, I provide some charity medical care in clinics where the doctors are unpaid and the hospital bills are covered by government programs. In other words, our tax dollars pay for the care provided. Fortunately, the clinic that I currently work in does not provide infertility surgery for indigent patients. I'm off the hook, but other people are not. These patients are referred to charity clinics that are run by the residency training programs. Here, these patients may undergo surgical treatment for their infertility if the residents feel that performing these operations would provide a good educational experience for themselves. Thus, we see that even in the simplest of infertility treatments, the mode and nature of treatment may be largely determined by the patient's financial status. Next slide. This is the situation. It is common in charity clinics to hear doctors and nurses discussing whether we should help indigent patients conceive a child which our taxes would have to support. Should poverty exclude someone from treatment? The diverse situations of the poor suggest to me that no one answer is correct for all situations. But obviously there are no easy answers. In our own private practice, we have on occasion provided surgical procedures for indigent married patients who have long been in our practice and who have temporarily fallen on hard times. Hormonal therapies, as I suggested before, may be used for either the male or female to promote gametes, that is, egg and sperm production. These therapies are less commonly used in the male, where they are also not fraught with ethical concerns, in my opinion. An example of hormonal treatment in the male would be Kallmann syndrome, a rare autosomal dominant disease which is characterized by low testosterone, low follicle stimulating hormone, and low luteinizing hormone. With hormonal therapy, these men can become fertile despite previous sperm counts of zero. In addition, benign pituitary tumors or prolactinomas and previous brain trauma can cause male infertility, which is correctable with hormonal therapy. Hormonal therapy in the female is much more commonly used than in the male. Some, but not all, of the female hormonal therapies present troubling ethical issues. There are currently numerous methods of female hormonal therapy available, with variations on each, again depending on the preferences of the treating physician. Let's look at these methods. First, we have Clomid or clomiphene citrate. Next, Pergonol or human menopausal gonadotropins. We also have human menopausal gonadotropins combined with intrauterine insemination of sperm. And finally, we have human menopausal gonadotropins combined with in vitro fertilization. Clomid therapy is chiefly indicated for women who are anovulatory or not producing eggs. It's a fairly simple treatment which involves 5 days of oral medication per cycle combined with the patient recording basal body temperatures on a daily basis. The incidence of twin gestation with Clomid therapy is about 8%. Three or more fetuses are rare. Clomid is frequently prescribed by persons such as myself, gynecologists who are not subspecialized in infertility treatment. And I have no major objections to the use of Clomid therapy for the treatment of anovulation. In contrast, Pergonol, or the human menopausal gonadotropins, are much more complicated. And this is true whether these drugs are used alone or in combination with intrauterine insemination or in vitro fertilization. Human menopausal gonadotropin therapy, or HMG therapy, is usually undertaken only by gynecologists who are subspecialized in infertility treatment. There are several ethical problems that arise with HMG therapy, as you can see from this slide. If you would back up one, please. HMG therapy can result in superovulation with multiple gestations involving as many as 7 embryos in one cycle. And when used with IVF, superovulation is intentional. The ethical issues involved with this will be discussed in a moment under the topic of IVF. But let's consider now HMG therapy alone. When it is used alone, more than 2 babies produced in one cycle can have a disastrous outcome. Large numbers of fetuses in one pregnancy usually leads to premature delivery with the loss of most or all of the babies. The problem of multiple gestation has led to the reprehensible practice of selective reduction. As one might expect, this scientific terminology doesn't sound too bad, but the details are grisly. In these cases, physicians selectively abort one or more babies while attempting to leave the other fetuses intact. This is done in hopes that the remaining 1 to 3 babies in the uterus will have a better chance of survival. In my opinion, it is indeed grisly business to kill some babies in utero while their nearby siblings are permitted to develop and mature. Needless to say, these procedures are emotionally devastating for the parents. Despite the potential problems with hormonal therapy for the female, I do not believe it should be avoided altogether. In expert hands, multiple gestations with more than 3 fetuses are generally avoidable by good medical practice. I believe HMG therapy alone may be a reasonable option for Christian couples, provided that they seek care from expert physicians and provided that they refuse selective reduction procedures should a multiple gestation occur. Next, let's discuss artificial insemination. Artificial insemination of the female with either her husband's or donated sperm involves several ethical issues. I see these as less complex than the issues in some of the other medical treatments. The sperm may be placed directly in the cervix, or it may be separated from the seminal fluid, washed, and then placed directly into the uterine cavity. This is called intrauterine insemination. There's little reliable data on the success rate of this, primarily because the indications for this procedure are variable. For example, a normal woman whose husband has no sperm is much more likely to conceive than a woman receiving this treatment in a case of unexplained infertility. Masturbation is required to obtain the sperm, whether it is obtained from the husband or the donor. Our own Missouri Synod's most recent CTCR document on marriage and sexuality condemns masturbation with the following explanation, and I quote them. Quite clearly, chronic masturbation falls short of the Creator's intention for our gift of sexuality, namely that our sexual drive should be oriented toward communion with another person in the mutual love and commitment of marriage. By its very nature, masturbation separates sexual satisfaction from the giving and receiving of sexual intercourse in marital union, and it is symptomatic of the tendency of human beings to turn in upon themselves for the satisfaction of their desires. End quote. Although I agree with these comments concerning the problem of chronic masturbation, this point of view does not seem to address the issues of infertility treatment. With artificial insemination, the personal satisfaction of sexual desires without regard for one's marriage partner is not an issue. Therefore, I feel that masturbation may be acceptable when it comes to infertility treatment. Now, the use of donor sperm raises the issue of third-party involvement and lineage disputes. If the sperm donor is a relative, a second family may be involved as well. These ethical issues are thus troubling for the parents as well as for the child. One must also consider the question of using artificial insemination to achieve pregnancy in single women and women involved in lesbian couples. Again, I hold to my position that it is not acceptable to work for pregnancy in unmarried women, although I am aware of physicians who are artificially inseminating such patients. I believe that in the context of a normal heterosexual marriage, the ethical issues with artificial insemination are not insurmountable problems and do not present absolute contraindications to treatment. Next, I'd like to discuss in vitro fertilization. As of July 1992, in vitro fertilization will have been an accepted method for the treatment of infertility for 14 years. Between 1985 and 1990, IVF produced some 10,000 American babies, according to the American Fertility Society. IVF was initially hailed as a miraculous breakthrough in medical technology. It is still being presented to patients in this way, as you see by this, which is the cover of an informational packet given to one of my patients by the nationally renowned IVF Center in Norfolk, Virginia. It is interesting that this patient, after reviewing the materials and talking with the physicians there, came to the conclusion that IVF was ethically unacceptable to her and her husband. Many Christians, in fact, have reservations about in vitro fertilization. In vitro fertilization, of course, is described in this slide. If you look at the right-hand side, we see that pregnancy is achieved by the joining of eggs and sperm in the laboratory, and the resulting embryos are later transferred to the uterus. The embryos created outside the human body are indeed human beings. What risks are these tiny human beings subjected to by being handled in a laboratory setting? Are their lives jeopardized in the process? Finding the answers to these questions has been very difficult. I recently attended a seminar which reviewed all of the latest techniques which the medical community calls assisted reproductive technologies. Even in this setting, physicians and laboratory specialists or embryologists were extremely reluctant to answer my questions about the handling of human embryos in the lab. I felt, in fact, like a spy on your behalf at this meeting. The process of IVF must be explained in detail to give a full understanding of the ethical issues involved. First, let's review the normal process of conception and early pregnancy. As this slide demonstrates, the egg is released from the ovary, it's picked up by the fimbriated end of the fallopian tube. Contrary to popular opinion, the egg is not fertilized in the uterus, but rather in the distal or mid portion of the fallopian tube. It then grows and divides during its five-day journey to the uterus. Implantation then occurs when the embryo burrows into the plush, thickened uterine lining. With IVF, the first 5 days of life from conception to implantation are accomplished in the laboratory rather than in the fallopian tube. Most patients undergoing IVF are given medications to stimulate the ovaries, and each stimulated cycle may have 7 or more eggs produced instead of the usual 1 egg per cycle. As many eggs as possible are removed from the ovaries by needle aspiration under ultrasound visualization. And here we see how this is done. A transvaginal ultrasound transducer is placed in the vagina to visualize the stimulated ovary, which you see in the dark inset photo on the left. This is how an ultrasonographer would see the ovary. Each one of the cystic or dark areas in that ovary contains an egg, which is then retrieved by aspirating the fluid with a needle guided by the ultrasound. And the patients receive light sedation for this procedure. An attempt is made to fertilize all the eggs obtained, and multiple human embryos such as these result. These are all 4-cell human embryos at various stages of development, with the top 2 developing poorly and the bottom 2 developing well. Next slide. Again, in this slide, we see a healthy 4-cell embryo on the left and a healthy 8-cell embryo on the right. Typically, 5 to 8 eggs might be obtained. Maybe 4 to 6 are successfully fertilized. However, not all of the resulting embryos are returned to the uterus. At the current time, most institutions return 4 embryos to the uterus. The reason not all of these embryos are returned to the uterus is, as I stated previously, that pregnancies involving more than one baby have much greater risks and may result in no living children. Some extra embryos may be frozen for later use. Alternatively, all of the embryos may be returned to the uterus, and if all survive, some are destroyed later by selective reduction. Neither embryo freezing nor selective reduction of implanted embryos are acceptable to the pro-life community. Next slide. In addition, there may be controversies such as these about the ownership of frozen embryos. In cases of divorce, human embryos may be ordered by judges to be destroyed in order to settle the case. But this is not the extent of the ethical problems we see with IVF. What other ethical issues are found behind the scenes in the embryology lab? Next slide. We now know that many factors such as correct temperature and pH are critical to the survival of human embryos in the lab. The fact is that optimal media and conditions for embryo survival is not known. I believe that many viable human embryos die due to laboratory procedures. For example, a nationally known keynote speaker at the symposium I attended made the following observation. The Center for IVF at Harvard had few surviving embryos to return to the uterus and no successful pregnancies for a period of time over 1 year. During this time, young physicians in their infertility training program were handling the work with the embryos in the lab. When these physicians were replaced with embryologists who did nothing but laboratory work, they doubled the number of embryos surviving. This improvement was presumably due to better laboratory techniques. John J. Stengel, MD, a director of a large U.S. in vitro center, stated recently, and I quote, "It may take 800 to 1,000 cycles to see if a small change in laboratory medium represents a real improvement in embryo survival." Another area of lab work which is of concern is that of embryo research. When IVF began 14 years ago, research on human embryos was discussed but never condoned. I now understand that embryo research is commonly performed in a process called embryo screening. This is a procedure where a biopsy is taken. In other words, cells are removed from the developing embryo to study the infant's DNA. The goal of this procedure is to prevent genetic diseases. The physicians doing this test are quick to point out, however, that there are some errors in testing. If pregnancy is achieved after an embryo is tested, they still recommend retesting the pregnant mother by means of chorionic villi sampling or amniocentesis to rule out errors. They also point out that tested embryos can survive as long as no more than 25% of the embryo's cells are removed by biopsy. It seems obvious that a number of human embryos died while the scientists were busy coming up with that statistic. Aside from DNA testing, there are other aspects to embryo screening as well. For example, embryos that show delayed fertilization or embryos fertilized by more than one sperm are not returned to the uterus because they have an 87% chance of having chromosomal abnormalities. In the lectures where this information was presented, no mention was made of the other 13% of these discarded embryos which were chromosomally normal. In this scenario, the value of numerous babies, whether normal or handicapped, is casually discounted as worthless. Another ethical issue at hand is perhaps one of the largest problems facing IVF technology, and this is the problem of failure of implantation. But actually, this is a multifaceted problem. The last three items that you see on our list here, namely failure of implantation, cryopreservation of embryos, and an abnormally high miscarriage rate, are all in fact interrelated problems. They must be discussed as a whole. First, we note that embryos created by laboratory techniques seem to have a greater difficulty implanting into the lining of the uterus than embryos from a naturally occurring pregnancy. And this explains why the pregnancy rate for IVF has always been quite poor, usually less than 25% pregnancy rate per cycle, despite an average cost to the patient of $10,000 per cycle. Next slide. Now, these are the latest statistics from McGee Women's Hospital in Pittsburgh to illustrate my point. I know this is hard to see, and you might wonder why I put such a mishmash of numbers on the screen, but these numbers are what's important to people who practice IVF therapy. This slide, you maybe won't be able to see the numbers, but this is what means everything to them. Both the statistics for GIFT and IVF are on this slide, but if you direct your attention to the highlighted numbers under IVF at the bottom of the table, you will find that the percent of patients becoming pregnant after successful egg retrieval varied from 10 to 26%, with an average pregnancy rate of only 19% over 4 years. Only 10 to 13% of IVF embryos that are returned to the uterus implant successfully. Some physicians consider this to be due to embryo damage in the lab, especially if the embryo was frozen prior to introducing it into the uterus. The statement has been made by the experts that there are some problems with embryo cryopreservation, but the nature of these problems is never clarified. It is clear that the cryopreserved embryos have less chance of survival the longer they are frozen. It's also known that embryo destruction is common during the thawing of these frozen embryos. Next slide. This slide shows one embryo in the upper left before freezing. The remaining three photos show the cell destruction that's seen in some embryos after freezing and thawing. On the bottom right, you can literally see the cell contents leaking out through a disrupted cell membrane. Next slide. This photo shows a blastocyst on the top, a more mature form of an embryo, and the upper photo is an intact early blastocyst. The two lower photos show a destroyed blastocyst after freezing and thawing. It has two cavities and no inner cell mass, the portion that which would have gone on to develop into a mature embryo. Next slide. Incidentally, I thought you might be interested in the cost of cryopreservation, so here are some figures, again taken from the Norfolk patient information brochures. It's interesting to note that they use the terms prezygotes and preembryos. Of course, these terms are scientific nonsense, and they are used only because the doctors hope to convince patients that the tissues being frozen are not really human beings. It's clear from the terminology that the IVF specialists want patients to believe that embryos only become human and of value, so to speak, after they've been returned to the uterus. And if you think that cryopreservation is expensive, if you'll take a look at the next slide, you can see that having your embryo thawed and placed in the uterus later on generates another expense in about the same amount. Obviously, IVF is a lucrative business. Next slide. This is again our statistics. We've discussed embryo damage in the lab as one cause of the low pregnancy rate with IVF, but another cause for failure to implant may be the abnormal nature of the uterine lining due to the hormones that are used to stimulate the ovaries during most IVF cycles. Even for embryos that do implant, the miscarriage rate for IVF pregnancies is 25% rather than the 15% seen in the normal population. The abnormally high miscarriage rate with IVF explains the difference we see between pregnancy rates of 19% with the ovary retrieval being done, but only 15% of those babies actually deliver a live infant. It's interesting that the physicians who perform IVF state that the implantation failure and abnormally high miscarriage rate are areas of, quote, major problems, unquote. Yet they never describe these problems in terms of the loss of human life. And in fact, their main concern seems to be how these losses affect the success rates as reported in the medical literature. The experts state at most conferences that the babies born to infertile couples by means of IVF justify any ethical problems involved. And my question to them is, can we afford to believe this? Now I'd like to turn your attention to GIFT, gamete intrafallopian transfer. In general, GIFT is slightly more successful than IVF, with a pregnancy rate of about 38% per retrieval and a delivery rate of 28% after miscarriages are factored out. Now to refresh your memory on this diagram, this is comparing GIFT and IVF. What you will see is that this is the intraoperative transfer of sperm and egg into the fallopian tube of the woman. Laparoscopy is required for the woman, a surgical procedure requiring general anesthesia and several small abdominal incisions. Fertilization occurs in the fallopian tube itself. Success rates vary, but may be as high as 30%. Masturbation may not be required. Condoms may be used to collect the sperm. Or donor sperm may be used, and sex selection may be possible. Now, this next slide will compare GIFT to IVF and ZIFT. GIFT entails none of the serious ethical considerations that we noted with IVF, and this is because there is no risk to the embryo. But unfortunately, this treatment is limited to patients with normal fallopian tubes, and one of the primary indications for IVF is non-functional or absent fallopian tubes. Therefore, GIFT cannot be used as an alternative for IVF in many cases. The ZIFT procedure, or zygote interfallopian transfer, involves the placement of zygotes or very young embryos into the fallopian tube. ZIFT, therefore, raises the same ethical concerns with respect to embryo damage as IVF. Again, it is limited to patients with normal fallopian tubes. Now I'd like to discuss surrogate embryo transfer. Numerous ethical concerns arise with this procedure, some of which are listed here. Surrogate embryo transfer involves artificial insemination of a surrogate mother with the husband's sperm. The surrogate mother refrains from sexual intercourse for several days prior to implantation to insemination. And then if pregnancy is achieved, the surrogate mother carries that embryo for only 5 days. The embryo is then washed out of her uterus and transferred to the uterus of the infertile wife. But in some cases, the embryo cannot be lavaged or washed out of the surrogate's uterus. In this case, she would either have to carry the child to term or have an abortion. Surrogate embryo transfer also requires the use of medications to synchronize the uterine lining into the same hormonal phase between the surrogate and the infertile wife. But if the infertile wife does not achieve proper synchronization of the uterine lining, then the embryo may be lavaged out of the surrogate and frozen until the wife's uterus is ready. As seen in IVF, embryo destruction is common and may occur during the freezing or again from the thawing in embryo transfer. The potential then for embryo destruction with surrogate embryo transfer is just as troubling as that seen with IVF. And in addition, some surrogate embryo transfer contracts actually require that the surrogate mother must have an abortion if the embryo cannot be lavaged out of her uterus. Next, surrogate motherhood. This is again another option for the treatment of infertility. Surrogate motherhood requires the artificially inseminated mother to carry the child for the entire pregnancy. These mothers sign a contract giving the biological father and his infertile wife custody of the child if successful pregnancy and delivery occur. Numerous ethical problems arise under these circumstances. First, we note that some surrogate motherhood contracts require the pregnant surrogate to have an abortion if her fetus is even suspected of being defective by the other parties. Also, surrogate motherhood raises insolvable problems due to third party or other family involvement. There's ample evidence of such problems, as we have seen in the case of baby M, and also a similar controversy in the biblical account of Sarah, Hagar, and Abraham. In addition, surrogate motherhood contracts encourage the exploitation of poor women by treating them as breeders who cannot buy their way out of contracts. These women may lose custody even if the contract is later declared null and void. Surrogate pregnancies for financial gain are still seen, as we see from headlines such as these. And finally, we note that nothing is known about the mental and physical effects of surrogate motherhood on the health of the child. Now, a final area of ethical concern has grown out of the current treatment regimens for infertility, and this is the area of prenatal genetic testing. The current trend in America is for women to delay childbearing for the sake of career development. As fertility gradually declines in the late 30s and early 40s, these same women are increasingly seeking treatment for infertility. And we now have an unprecedented number of well-informed, educated women who are having their first child between the ages of 35 and 45. And this has created, in turn, a demand for prenatal genetic testing since the fetal abnormalities rise with increasing maternal age. But is such testing safe for the unborn child? Many pro-life patients have concerns about prenatal genetic testing. They would like to find out if their unborn baby is a normal child, but they fear that testing may endanger the child's life. They also may fear that they would be advised to have an elective abortion if the child were found to be abnormal. But I believe that such counseling and testing in a pro-life manner with such patients can be undertaken, and I would like to share with you how we go about this in our practice. Next slide. This is my premise, that it is morally acceptable for all parents to attempt to find out if their unborn child is normal, provided that genetic testing does not endanger the life of that unborn child. It is regrettable that some parents will use findings of an abnormal baby as an excuse to undergo elective abortion. However, we have many patients in our practice who desire prenatal genetic testing even though they would never consider having an elective abortion. Some of these parents feel they would be better equipped to deal with a handicapped child if they knew in advance that such a baby was coming. And others correctly believe that better medical care might be afforded such a child if the baby's problems were diagnosed before birth, and this in fact is true. The most common types of prenatal genetic testing are seen next. First, we have traditional amniocentesis, then chorionic villi sampling, and finally early amniocentesis. Now first, let's discuss traditional amniocentesis. This test involves drawing fluid by needle out of the bag of water at about 16 weeks gestation. Amniocentesis is done to see if the baby's chromosomes are normal. One of the most common chromosomal abnormalities that can be detected by amniocentesis is Down syndrome or trisomy 21. In most cases, the fluid is also tested for alpha-fetoprotein to rule out neural tube defects. Now, at the current time, amniocentesis is routinely offered to all women who will be 35 years of age or older at the time of the baby's birth. This is because the risk of Down syndrome goes up with increasing maternal age. My patients frequently ask me, how risky is it to be over 35 when having a baby? And my answer usually is, not very risky. It's interesting that the routine practice of offering genetic amniocentesis to women over 35 is actually based more on the number of doctors available to do the test than on the increase in risk at that particular age. Because actually, you see, the risk of Down syndrome goes up very gradually as a woman gets older, until the age of 40, at which time there is a sharp increase in risk for all types of chromosomal abnormalities. But there is no sudden increase in risk at age 35, as you can see from the next slide. These are our statistics. The incidence of Down syndrome occurs about once out of every 365 deliveries to women age 35, and then the risk gradually increases to once in 109 deliveries at age 40. I like to point out that the risk for Down syndrome is approximately 1% for women who are 40 years of age at delivery time. And I also like to turn these numbers around and point out to my patient that 99% of babies born to 40-year-old mothers will not have Down syndrome. Even if you consider all types of chromosomal abnormalities, 98.4% of babies born to a 40-year-old mother will be normal. Therefore, my partners and I feel very comfortable caring for pregnant women 40 and under, and even a few who are 40 and over. We can care for them comfortably even if they do not wish to have genetic amniocentesis. All of our patients over 40 in the last 6 years have delivered normal babies with normal chromosomes. But still, I am aware that many of our pro-life patients still require testing or desire testing. Some of them are totally opposed to genetic amniocentesis because they feel that it jeopardizes the life of the baby. And it is true that some women in the past have miscarried from complications due to a genetic amniocentesis. In the medical literature, the reported rate of miscarriage due to genetic amniocentesis is 1 out of 200 pregnancies tested. However, these are very old statistics. These numbers were generated from a time when ultrasound may not have been used to assist with the amniocentesis, and when the resolution of the cameras used was not as good as at the present time. I believe that genetic amniocentesis can be completely safe for the unborn baby, but only under carefully controlled circumstances. Most cases of fetal death from amniocentesis occurred years ago when needles were passed blindly into the uterus to draw fluid without the help of ultrasound visualization. Now, this is an example of the way that the earliest amniocentesis tests were done. And as you can see, the physician's hand is pushing the baby out of the way. The needle is inserted with no guidance in hopes that there is nothing important in the way. Next slide. Today, it's common practice to use ultrasound to locate the baby, the placenta, and the umbilical cord before passing a needle into a safe fluid pocket that is well away from these structures. And this is how genetic amniocentesis is done today. In most practices, but not all, the physicians actually watch the needle pass through each layer of the abdominal wall and each layer of the uterus and even through those membranes to reach that safe pocket of fluid. But I should also point out that the pro-life or pro-abortion stance of the physician may contribute to the safety of the amniocentesis. How can this be? I can best explain this by stating that all obstetricians know that some patients present more risks for the baby during amniocentesis than others, particularly if the placenta covers the entire anterior wall of the uterus or if the baby or cord position make most of the fluid pockets inaccessible. Because my partners and I are so committed to the pro-life movement, we simply call off the amniocentesis if we feel that it would be too risky for the baby, and we have in many cases done this. And I think that that is why we have never lost a baby due to amniocentesis. Next slide. In summary, these are the factors that I consider essential for a safe genetic amniocentesis. Namely, that the mother must be at least 16 to 18 weeks gestation, the placental location must be good, ultrasound guidance must be used, and last but not least, the physician performing the test should have a pro-life physician. We now need to turn our attention to other methods of determining fetal chromosome makeup. The most common alternative to traditional amniocentesis is a procedure called chorionic villi sampling, or CVS. I am opposed to the use of CVS because I do believe it may endanger the life of the unborn child. CVS testing requires that a small portion of the placenta be suctioned out of the uterus to provide fetal cells for testing. These placental fragments or villi are obtained in one of two ways. The next slide shows the first of these. In some cases, this plastic tube or catheter is passed through the cervical canal into the uterus to suction cells from the placenta. Next slide. The alternative method is to pass a needle through the abdominal wall to suction cells out of the placenta. But I'd like to point out that doing a transabdominal CVS test with a posterior placenta, as you see in the insert photo, this is extremely difficult, if not impossible. Both transvaginal and transabdominal methods of chorionic villi sampling are done under direct visualization with the ultrasound machine, but there are numerous risks to CVS, which I list on the next slide. When first introduced, CVS was hailed by physicians as being very effective for early testing, and it was reported to cause abortions in only 4 to 5% of the women tested. But the physicians doing the tests at our conferences admit that it is very difficult to perform and that the doctors tend to cause less abortions as they gain more experience with the procedure. Most centers performing CVS now claim the procedure causes a woman to miscarry 1% of the time or less, but none of my pro-life comrades nor I believe these statistics. This, even if you accept these statistics, though, this is in contrast to traditional amniocentesis, which I previously described as having no fetal losses in our practice or in any reputable practices that I am aware of. And I believe that the difference in safety of traditional amniocentesis versus CVS is due to number of factors. First, amniocentesis is a very easy procedure for physicians to master. It is much simpler to draw fluid out of the bag of water than to suction cells out of the placenta without disrupting the pregnancy. And in addition, it is impossible to remove all the bacteria from the cervix before passing a catheter through that cervical canal when doing transvaginal CVS. Therefore, some women become infected from cervical bacteria that are introduced into the placental tissue during the procedure, and these infections in turn lead to miscarriage. As I stated previously, the reason that not all CVS tests are done transabdominally is because the placental implantation sites on the posterior uterine wall are not accessible by that route. Finally, we have begun to note recently clusters of cases of fetal limb defects in babies born after CVS testing. The next shows you an example of just such a child. Apparently, the CVS testing may cause amniotic bands that cause sloughing of the fetal fingers or limbs in early fetal development. This baby has lost most of his fingers. Now, proponents of CVS state that they believe the number of abortions caused by the procedure is low enough to now be an acceptable risk, and I cannot accept this point of view. It should be noted that the reason CVS was developed was specifically because it allows testing earlier in pregnancy. CVS is generally done at about 10 weeks gestation, and this would make it easier for a woman to go through an elective abortion if they are unhappy with the findings derived from CVS. With traditional amniocentesis, the test results may not be known until 18 to 20 weeks gestation, by which time the mother can already appreciate fetal movement. Next slide. Now, the third method of chromosomal analysis in early pregnancy is called early amniocentesis. This test is identical to traditional amniocentesis, except for the fact that it may be done as early as 10 to 13 weeks gestation. This early gestational age is characterized by a very tiny fetus with a much smaller gestational sac, and it is much more difficult to remove fluid at this gestational age without disturbing the pregnancy. Some babies, again, are therefore lost due to the procedure. A recent article by a researcher in this field of early amniocentesis states that the higher risk of fetal loss remains, quote, the big question. And a soon-to-be-published paper regarding early amniocentesis states there is a 3.4% rate of pregnancy loss with this procedure versus 2 to 3% normal or spontaneous abortion rate. For this reason, I do not condone early amniocentesis. Now, I realize this digression into fetal genetic testing may not seem pertinent to the infertility issue at hand this morning, but I argue that it is an issue because our mothers are now older due to infertility treatments, and they know that once they get pregnant, that doesn't necessarily mean that there will be a baby. Now, in closing, I'd like to direct your attention to the table at the very end of your handout. This table you can review at your leisure. It does not cover prenatal genetic testing, but it's otherwise a very useful summary of our discussion regarding assisted reproductive technologies. And this table is taken from the Christian Medical Society Journal and was prepared by Dr. David Scheidermeyer, who is a CMS member. Now, the most important numbers here are the individual scores assigned to each method of treatment, with individual scores of 3 or 4 indicating ethical concerns so great as to discourage that treatment entirely. And the total scores are just given to indicate the overall number of ethically concerning factors with each treatment. This concludes my presentation. I'd like to thank you for your attention.
At this time, I would like to introduce Dr. Randall Shields. Dr. Randall Shields is campus pastor at Concordia College, Ann Arbor, Michigan.
First, a biographical note, as the lights are attempted to be raised here for us. Infertility has never been a personal concern for me. It has never been a topic of conversation shared between my wife and myself. We do share 4 children, one of whom we were called upon to do a little teamwork in delivering in the absence of an attending physician while riding in the cab of a pickup truck, an experience I do not encourage any of you to have, but one that we will always remember. Parenthood is a fact that I simply share for the sake of information or as a backdrop for my presentation, and perhaps it would suggest that a more accurate subtitle for my presentation would be a fertile theological perspective on infertility. And I think that would suggest at a deeper level that our theology should always be fertile, lest our witness become infertile. You should have an outline in your hands to follow the flow of this presentation. And whether or not the lights come up, we will proceed. If we could go back to our beginning, if we could go back to that marital union which resulted in our conception, in those passionate moments when there were only two and not yet three, we were but a gleam in our Father's eye and a smile on our mother's face. But that gleam and that smile are not always the prelude to a parent's doxology. If life does not begin in that moment of marital union, the gleam and the smile may be lost in the clinical atmosphere of investigation. And what follows is sometimes called the pain of infertility. Martha Stout, in her book, Without Child, A Compassionate Look at Infertility, writes, "I watched a mountain ash outside my bedroom window during the winter of my infertility. From time to time, throughout that gray season, I looked up into its bare, overhanging branches and prayed, just as spring will bring bud and blossom to this winter-blasted tree, so you, Lord, in your power can bring forth life in me. Winter slipped away, and with spring came white blossoms and bright orange berries to the once barren tree. But spring did not come similarly to me. The child I prayed for was not to be." Let us step back and consider what her not to be was meant to be. We know that the legacy of humankind is the legacy of male and female origins. With meticulous care, God fashioned, breathed, and made male and female. God created sex. He made it two-dimensional. There would be variety. There would be physiological and psychological differences to be understood and respected. There would be male and female. There would be families, not random individuals. It was very good. It was ideal. Sexual intercourse was made to be two-dimensional. There is the dimension of unity, the intimate sharing of love between male and female. Not only communicates their strong feelings and desires for one another, but also gives continued expression to the oneness of their marriage. The unitive dimension of sexual intercourse embraces the companionship purpose of marriage. The blueprint for companionship was drawn up when Eve was created from the rib of Adam while he slept. From the beginning of their companionship, Adam and Eve were flesh and bone of one another. Adam's companion had been made from Adam. Eve's companion had become part of Eve. These made for one another companions would mutually share their conjugal love. Physical, emotional, and spiritual oneness would merge. The unitive dimension of sexual intercourse would enrich the companionship purpose of marriage. God's plan for sexual intercourse also included a procreative dimension, intended to actualize the procreative purpose of marriage. God's first recorded words to Adam and Eve were, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it." Male and female, made in the likeness of God, were to do as God had done. The marital union was intended to be a life-sharing act. Adam and Eve were not to live for themselves. They were to live procreatively. God's plan was to have the love-sharing and life-giving dimensions of sexual intercourse blend in concert-like harmony. Ethicist Paul Ramsey has summarized this plan by simply stating that sexual intercourse, and I quote, "tends of its own nature toward the strengthening of love, the unitive or communicative good, and toward the engendering of children, the procreative good. This will be the nature of human sexual relations," end quote. According to the plan, there should be neither sexual exploitation nor infertility. But we know the human problem, and it has been touched upon at several points through this symposium. The plan was shattered in the explosion of sin, and that explosion became the universal human problem. Confrontation, temptation, and desperation converge in the tragedy of Genesis 3. Both male and female disobeyed the word of the Lord. The goodness within was gone. Sex would no longer be what it was meant to be. The giving and the receiving and the ruling would be tarnished by a corrupted human nature whose trademark would be selfishness. Sexual identity, expression, and purpose would become unclear, unclean, and uncertain. The awful residue of imperfection would fall upon everyone, and it would evidence itself in many different forms. This historical context must be established and acknowledged. The problem of infertility, pardon the pun, was conceived in an ancient garden. The pain of infertility has spread far beyond that garden. The pain of infertility is the pain of unfulfilled desires. Consider John and Karen. They want to become parents, but month after month they only find the flow of menstrual blood. John begins to question his masculinity. Karen begins to worry about the functioning of her female organs. All of their close friends already have children. Unspoken comparisons are inevitable when they are together socially. Instead of learning what it means to be parents, John and Karen must come to grips with the pain of infertility. Their desires have not been fulfilled, and over time, the pain is compounded. A sense of isolation may set in as the pain of infertility becomes a question, who will understand my feelings? This sense of isolation can impose invisible barriers, causing the infertile to feel excluded from the social mainstream. Imaginary loneliness becomes real loneliness. For some, the problem of isolation becomes a fixed notion that they do not belong or that they have lost their niche in the ranks of the extended family. The problem of isolation will be magnified if the infertile person experiences a loss of self-esteem. Comparatively speaking, there is less stigma and much more social acceptance of childlessness today than in previous generations. In fact, within some circles, the condition is even advocated. Nonetheless, both men and women often view their infertility as a villain, threatening or actually undermining their self-esteem. A case in point would be a man named Leonard, who was in the Air Force during his first infertility workup, heard about his sterility from a lab technician who mistakenly assumed he had undergone a vasectomy. The technician said, "Congratulations, no sperm seen." And Leonard recalls, "I'd always been so cool, thinking I was doing all this medical stuff for my wife. I began to realize I was also doing it for me. I sat and stared dumbly straight ahead and discovered there was a whole lot more sorrow inside than I had known. It shook me to the core." The infertile may also struggle with feelings of guilt. Not the guilt that issues from the accusing voice of God's law, but guilt imposed by self-recrimination. Those with a weak self-image are especially susceptible to this problem. Scrambling for answers that will explain their infertility, and perhaps in search of a bargaining chip with which to placate God's apparent disfavor, the infertile often become victims of their own irrational feelings of guilt. It is common for the infertile to feel guilty when they have established in their mind a cause and effect relationship between some undefined inadequacy or sin and their condition of infertility. The following example illustrates some of the turmoil of this problem. This woman wrote, "We are Catholics. Not a week goes by that I don't hear that familiar portion of the Mass asking us to add our intentions to the prayer. Every week I ask God to grant us a child. I light a vigil candle. I pray to Mary. Surely as a mother, she will understand and intercede for me. I am afraid that priests and fellow parishioners who do not know me and our situation will assume that we do not follow the teachings of the church and that we practice birth control. What else can you assume about a young, healthy couple married 9 years with no children? Once when I was in confession, I confessed to the sin of being jealous toward a friend because she was pregnant, while I could not conceive a child. Mostly I confessed this sin because it was true. but I also confessed it because I wanted the priest to know that I was an infertile Catholic, not a bad Catholic. The problems connected with the pain of infertility may also ignite the emotional fuse of anger. An innocent comment by a friend or relative or a doctor's inability to diagnose the cause of the infertile condition may suddenly elevate simmering frustrations and turn them into a boiling emotional outburst. The infertile will most frequently focus their anger upon God, whom they feel has betrayed or deprived them, or upon their spouse, whom they blame for the problem. If the anger becomes entrenched hostility rather than a cathartic release of strong feelings, a potentially destructive wedge can be driven between either a divine human relationship or a marriage relationship. We turn now to the possibilities. This first statement should be heard clearly. Infertility should be distinguished from sterility. Infertility is not necessarily a permanent condition. There is a very real possibility of correcting or reversing a diagnosed cause of infertility through medical treatment. We have heard some of that this morning very thoroughly. Statistically speaking, an infertile couple's possibility of conceiving increases from 5% without medical help to over 50% with it. And we do believe that God works through medical means. An infertility workup will involve a cost factor, a time factor, and a patience factor. But it may just be the winding road that leads to the nursery. Infertile couples should not hesitate to explore legitimate medical possibilities. But in doing so, they should be aware that their bedrooms may become less private and their sex life more clinical. The adoption process, although often taking upwards from 2 to 5 years to complete, should be considered a bright possibility for those who desire a child to love and nurture. Because of the staggering number of abortions in this country, the adoptive parent waiting list is long. There are simply fewer children available for adoption today than there were prior to the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision of 1973. Adoptive parents may have to extend their horizons beyond that of the healthy newborn to include ethnic diversity or children with mental or physical impairments. As the children of God, we have all been adopted into God's family. He chose us before the foundations of the world. It is a privilege beyond compare to be adopted as sons and daughters of the King. Our spiritual roots provide a beautiful analogy for adoptive parents who will want their children to know how special they are and that they were chosen to be loved. When a Christian couple are unable to conceive genetic offspring, but still they desire to become parents and to raise a family, the obvious solution is to lavish their affection on a child who otherwise would be deprived of the love and security of a Christian home. When the childless embrace the homeless, a new family is born in the giving and receiving of love. There are other possibilities available to the childless couple. Again, we have been exposed by Dr. Rader to that catalog of medical possibilities. The ones that I've singled out on the outline, artificial insemination by donor, AID, embryo transfer, in vitro fertilization, and surrogate mothering, are, in my judgment, strictly speaking, not the traditional practice of medicine in the diagnostic and treatment sense, but rather in the term that Leon Cass, who is on the medical faculty at the University of Chicago, he used the term cosmetic medicine. cosmetic medicine, meaning that though the couple may receive a child through the procedure, the cause of the infertility still remains and has not been corrected. The couple will still be infertile. And at the same time, serious moral questions do relate to each of these possibilities. Again, Dr. Rader touched on several of those moral questions. We raised the question, does the end justify the means? Should a childless couple become a child-rearing couple, that would be the desired end, by any available means, AID, embryo transfer, IVF, surrogate mothering? For a situation ethicist such as Joseph Fletcher, steeped in the worldview of the secular humanist, the answer would be yes, with this added commentary, and I quote Fletcher, "It seems to me that laboratory reproduction is radically human compared to conception by ordinary heterosexual intercourse. It is willed, chosen, purposed, and controlled, and surely these are among the traits that distinguish Homo sapiens from others in the animal genus, from the primates down. Coital reproduction is, therefore, less human than laboratory reproduction. More fun, to be sure, but with our separation of baby-making from love-making, both become more human because they are matters of choice and not chance. This is, of course, essentially the case for Planned Parenthood." Fletcher concludes, "I cannot see how either humanity or morality are served by genetic roulette." End of quote. There are many professionals in the fields of medicine and ethics who have postured themselves alongside of Fletcher. The general population has also been attracted to these procedures, often lured by the media with its headline accounts of technological success and so-called happy endings. One could raise the caveat, proceed with caution, but in my judgment, that would be too mild. It would be my conclusion that these matters infringe upon God's design for our sexuality within the context of marriage and the family. Such infringement renders the procedures possibilities to avoid rather than to recommend. In its study document, Human Sexuality, A Theological Perspective, the Social Concerns Committee of the Commission on Theology and Church Relations of the LCMS wrote, "In a world which has become increasingly technical and depersonalized, the Christian church is called to bear witness to the human significance of the bond between male and female, to the purposes which God as creator and preserver has implanted in marriage, and to the ways in which such an understanding should shape our lives. To hold up before people once again the human, personal significance of our fundamental fleshly relationship, to explore the mysterious image of God's love in the one flesh union of husband and wife, and to recognize in wonder and humility the limitations which our creaturely condition places upon us. All this is part of fidelity to that God who has redeemed us, not that we may flee from his creation, but that we may cherish it and find in it intimations of his love." And I would concur. And now I would share with you a pastoral perspective based upon biblical principles, noting at the outset that pastors are not called to be infertility specialists. Pastors are called to be under-shepherds who take heed to all the flock in which the Holy Spirit has made them guardians. But the caring under-shepherd whose law and gospel ministry intersects with the needs of his people will also want to take heed to those in the flock whose pain is the pain of infertility. The infertile will more easily come to their pastor for counsel if his ministry has crafted a caring atmosphere that radiates love for hurting people. Perhaps in his preaching and teaching, he will have already opened the door on this subject. A pastoral perspective on infertility will always take its cue from biblical principles. Unconditional love. Personified in the ministry of Jesus and modeled by caring pastors in their congregations, can unlatch the door of the isolation chamber where some of the infertile have retreated. In the body of Christ, we are to bear one another's burdens, the burdens of a colostomy, the burden of hearing impairment, the burden of a crippled limb, the burden of infertility, and so fulfill the law of Christ. The law of love should so envelop the ministry of the church that it becomes a burden-bearing fellowship. The magnetic nature of God's love, when lived and spoken, can draw the infertile from a feeling of isolation into a network of support. This love that supports may be as basic as the counseling context with a gentle pastor, or as elaborate as a formal support group based within the congregation or the community. Responsible referral may be a loving pastor's response to the problem of isolation as well. The God-given value of individual worth is a biblical principle mentioned at several points previous in this symposium. The pastor skilled at teaching will assist the infertile in recognizing that God-given value, and hence their self-esteem, does not hinge upon whether or not they become natural parents. The hinge, however, in this biblical truth, my Creator has made me in His image, my Redeemer has called me by name and I am His, my Sanctifier has chosen my body as His temple. Here is the seedbed for self-esteem. God has willed our existence. He fashioned, sacrificed, and illuminated. His work in the past, the present, and in the future gives individual worth. Sprouting from this seedbed of truth will be the recognition that the term infertile should not define who a person is. Infertile is a descriptive term, one of many that could apply to a given individual and yet never tell their whole story or measure their worth. Self-esteem will rise or fall according to how a person is defined or how they define themselves. The pastor will help the infertile to build their self-esteem as they learn to define themselves according to God's grace. The starting point for genuine self-esteem is to be found outside of ourselves, not inside of ourselves. A pastoral perspective on infertility will include the biblical principle of confession and absolution. A careful application of this principle is critical when dealing with the problem of real guilt. Real guilt is not based on vague feelings of inadequacy, but on the reality of sin. It is not uncommon for the infertile to connect past sexual sins with their present condition of infertility. Premarital and extramarital sex, perhaps resulting in a sexually transmitted disease or even an abortion, can become the cause of real guilt. God's law justly accuses, and the grinding voice of a guilty conscience troubles and torments. David wrote in Psalm 32, "When I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me, my strength was sapped as in the heat of summer." But in the subsequent verses of that psalm, David wrote of the healing that he experienced through confession and absolution. He was broken by God's law and received forgiveness through the message of the gospel. So through confession and absolution, the guilt of past sins completely dissolves. Letting go of those sins through genuine repentance and fully accepting God's grace in Christ, that is, believing the word of forgiveness, requires a steady diet of law, gospel, preaching, teaching, and befriending. But it works. The comforting message of the crucified Christ, who was given into death for the sins of the world, and specifically for my sin at this moment in time, this is the only remedy for real guilt. Now, the problem of imposed or imagined guilt should also be sponged away by a correct understanding of confession and absolution. Vague feelings of inadequacy on the part of an infertile spouse may conjure up a sense of guilt. This, in turn, may seem to supply the answer when he or she struggles with the question, "Why am I infertile?" Coming to the conclusion, "It must be because I'm such a bad person. God is punishing me for my sins." This kind of fill-in-the-blank guilt is used by some to explain their infertility. An imposed sense of guilt can become a web of entangled recrimination from which the infertile never escape. Regretfully, some do not want to escape because their pain gives them the illusion of atoning for their sin. when in fact it is Christ who has atoned for all of their sin. The message of the gospel, when truly received, begins to diminish any lingering sense of inadequacy. Given the condition of original sin, to be sure, we are all bad people. But given the work of Christ, bad people have been declared saints. The clarifying pastor will, however, remind people that actions do have consequences. A pattern of immoral sexual conduct, or for that matter, a single instance, is an action that can have serious health consequences. Venereal diseases have become rampant throughout the world. These diseases often cause infertility. Abortion procedures, claimed by some to be safer than childbirth itself, are not without complications, and sometimes the complications cause infertility, or to be more exact, the woman can be rendered sterile. The pain of infertility may be directly connected to the painful truth that actions have consequences. For some, this is a reality they must face and learn to live with, but not alone. While confession and absolution is not a time machine that can reverse the sinful act or a wonder drug that can remove infectious scarring from the fallopian tubes, it is a real spiritual exercise cleansing us from all unrighteousness. Jesus, the spiritual healer, has said unconditionally, "Whoever comes to me, I will never drive away." A word of caution, however, is also in order. Cause and effect relationships between past behavior and a present condition of infertility should not be generalized. The clarifying pastor will want to share Martha Stout's insight with an infertile couple when she writes, and I quote, "We have about as much control over our fertility as we have over the color of our eyes or the size of our feet. And if children were a reward for virtue and barrenness a punishment for sin, if it were really that simple, then fewer scoundrels and more saints would be having them. If, for instance, there really was a one-to-one correspondence between sexual impurity and infertility, I think we would see a drop in the birth rate that would make our heads spin." Infertility is not a curse from God because of personal unworthiness. It is part of the aftermath of the first sin. We live in a fallen world, and this will always be the context for confession and absolution. And now the biblical principle of what I call sanctified suffering, which has many pastoral applications, and infertility is one of them. Sanctified suffering is a spiritual maturing process that can wrestle with God in prayer and still affirm His goodness when the answer is no. Sanctified suffering is the crucible of pain where a God-pleasing desire is denied, but the gracious providence of God is still affirmed. Sanctified suffering will be more than an occasional experience for God's people. Nurtured in the Spirit, through the apostolic words recorded in Romans, the 8th chapter, we are pilgrims whose journey from time to eternity frequently intersects with sanctified suffering. And this is good, mysteriously good. Yet the pain of infertility can breed frustration. Frustration at its melting point becomes anger. This human emotion will understandably have an object, whether it be God anger or spouse anger or doctor anger. These personal objects become the target for an explosive expression of blame. It is not an easy transition to move away from anger to sanctified suffering, but it is a necessary transition. Anger that does not mellow into sanctified suffering can eventually harden into spiritual deadness. The ventilator of anger needs pastoral acceptance. Absorbing and deflecting the anger of the infertile will facilitate the transition to sanctified suffering. The medication of the Holy Spirit, carefully applied, can soften the pain of unfulfilled desires. A raw nerve ending begins to heal. Spiritual insight and God-given wisdom begin to surface. The absence of the life-giving dimension of sexual intercourse does not erode the unitive dimension of the act. nor does it reduce the wholeness of the marriage relationship. An inability to experience the procreative purpose of marriage does not in itself render the marriage incomplete. Those who never become natural parents may have to learn to live with a sense of loss. Because of their unfulfilled desires, the infertile may feel that there is a void in their marriage without children to love and to raise. But children do not make marriage a marriage. Children are a blessing from the Lord, Psalms 127, 128. The blessing, however, brings adornment to the marriage, not completion. Remember the formula in Genesis, the second chapter. Leave, cleave, and become one flesh. These are the indispensable elements of marriage. Children are not a right, but an additional blessing. When God created Adam and Eve, he initially blessed them. And then he said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number." This commandment was an additional action to the action of the previous blessing. Through sanctified suffering, an infertile couple will learn that a childless marriage is still a marriage in the full sense of the word. The marriage relationship is delicate and sometimes fragile, but it must always be sacrificial. This is the essence of sanctified suffering. Forgiven sinners will translate the sacrifice of Christ for their sins into the sacrificial nature of the marriage relationship. When there is sacrificial, leaving, cleaving, and becoming, both marriage partners will grow together in their understanding of sanctified suffering. Theodore Beauvais said it so well in his book, Handbook to Marriage, when he wrote, "True marriage begins where our self is prepared to die. When I am prepared to sacrifice my own will, my habits, my rights, my personal ambition, my private thoughts." Sacrifice hurts. The pain of infertility hurts. But sanctified suffering is not an act of stoic resignation. The husband and wife in an infertile marriage share in a grieving process that is wrapped in sacrificial love for one another. A childless marriage is not a time for tearing down, but for building up. Infertility is a specific life problem, which in a general way both spouses have already promised in their marriage vows to willingly accept and to share that burden together. The marriage relationship that is in Christ will be strengthened in Christ to patiently accept the condition of infertility, even though it hurts. Only sanctified suffering can embrace the words of the psalmist who said, "It was good for me to be afflicted so that I might learn your decrees." Desires must always be subject to limitations, even when those desires are in themselves not wrong. The creature remains creature, subject to the Creator God who has power and authority to open and close wombs. An infertile couple, eager to provide a loving Christian home for children, struggle to conceive. Meanwhile, the promiscuous sleep around, conceive, and abort. The infertile couple will ask, "Why? It seems so unfair." And there is no logic to it. There is no satisfying answer. Sanctified suffering will always be shrouded by the imponderable why. If the infertile couple becomes too weighed down by that imponderable why, pastoral care should nudge them to move on. Sanctified suffering is not a stagnation of the human spirit, but an odyssey with the Holy Spirit, who has engendered the gift of faith. Thankfully, for some, the odyssey has ended like this. After years of wrestling with their infertility, this couple wrote, "We no longer view God as a cosmic vending machine that delivered whatever we selected from its storehouse of goodies, or as a doting father who bestowed on his children whatever their hearts desired. We were forced to trust God, even when his actions were incomprehensible to us. In short, we got used to living on God's terms, not ours. It was a terribly difficult lesson to learn. It is never easy to put your life in God's hands, especially when you believe that he is not going to give you what you want. After nearly 6 years, we found we could think positively about the future, take our lives off hold, and be happy again. We learned to be thankful for what we had, each other, our health, important work to do, and a God who really cares for us, and not to dwell on what we did not have. In conclusion, there are at least 5 instances of infertility recorded in the scriptures. In Genesis, the accounts of Leah and Rachel suggest that infertility can lead to tension and marital conflict between husband and wife. The wife of Manoah in the book of Judges is described as barren and having no children. Hannah in 1 Samuel was deeply distressed and wept bitterly because she had no children. In the opening chapter of Luke's gospel, Elizabeth, wife of Zechariah the priest, is described as a woman who had lived for many years with the social stigma of infertility. And the story of Sarah and Abraham stands out as the most detailed narrative concerning the pain of infertility. But in each of these instances, children are finally born. The wives become mothers. The husbands became fathers. The infertility was not a permanent condition. God intervened. Miraculously, it would have to be said, in the cases of Elizabeth and Sarah, given their advanced years. The scripture tells us that God remembered Rachel. He listened to her and opened her womb. And likewise of Hannah, we are told the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time, Hannah conceived and gave birth to a son. And the psalmist declared, "He settles the barren woman in her home as a happy mother of children. Praise the Lord." Infertile women from the past as well as the present have experienced this joy. The biblical examples of unexpected and miraculous pregnancies are not meant to tantalize a childless couple with a dangling carrot that will forever remain beyond their grasp. The word of the Lord has given us beacons of hope and encouragement to believe that God is in charge and individuals are his personal concern. So regardless of how the story may end, pregnancy, adoption, or remaining childless, a Christian will praise the Lord. The pain of infertility is not the last word. Confessing Christians have a capacity for constructive transformation. Nothing in the Christian's life, regardless of how bleak or painful it may be, is a waste. Even in the midst of barrenness, God can bring forth life. By the grace of God, childlessness can result in greater self-knowledge, a stronger, more mature faith, and a deeper reservoir of compassion. One young woman wrote, "I can now truly thank God for this whole infertility experience. It has made both my husband and me more compassionate when dealing with the trials and heartaches experienced by members of our church, and it has also made us more sensitive to hurting people in all walks of life. I thank God for this season of weeping, for how could I ever fully taste and appreciate the joys of life without first passing through the bitter waters of sorrow?" There are few, if any, reminders more effective than that of pain in alerting us to the sorrow and needs of others. An increased sense of compassion, a strong sense of vocation, the energies and love that would have been lavished upon children now focused upon others in service to the Lord. God can fill the void of the childless. There can still be a gleam in the eye and a smile on the face. Flowers can grow in the desert. Thank you.